It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Earlier this month, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto signed an executive order creating the city's first Office of Equity, designed to address inequalities. The new office replaces the Bureau of Neighborhood Empowerment that was created 5 years ago. I recently met with the mayor in his office and asked him if that bureau had not lived up to what he intended.
We have departments in budget and finance that look at, are we doing our job effectively? We have innovation and performance that basically says, are we doing it efficiently? But we don't have a department or a bureau in the city that's asking the question, are we doing it equitably?
So what does that mean?
It means when we put out our paving budget, we're not only going to look to making sure that it's done effectively and efficiently, but we're going to look and measure what neighborhoods are seeing more paving and which neighborhoods are seeing less. Everything that we do as a city and as a service will be put through the lens of equity. We are the fifth city in this country to create this department, and we intend to work with both national and local organizations to provide annual reports that will go back to the public to show that where we are succeeding and to show where we are failing.
It's replacing the Bureau of Neighborhood Empowerment. So is this new office, is this neighborhood focused and the challenges, the opportunities that neighborhoods face, or is it more people focused?
It's more people focused. It's very interesting, and I've really come to understand this, that in the history of the world, the Renaissance movement was followed by the humanist movement. And instead of the arts and technology and everything else that was part of the Renaissance, the world in Europe began to look at what we were doing for people.
You indicated in your executive order that you want this office to address inequalities in and outside local government. Really, what can you accomplish? What can you do other than being a vocal advocate to level the playing field for all?
It's much more challenging outside government, and the measurements are much more difficult to be able to show where there is success and failure. But at a minimum, there will be 13 people that will be a part of this office who will be the ambassadors to each of the other critical communities throughout the city. So whether those communities are immigrants and refugees or veterans or small business, what we want to be able to do is then to encourage them and empower them to add equity to their business model, whether it's a nonprofit organization or it's a large institution or it's a company. We want to be able to show what we're doing and to be able to hopefully build that out beyond just the city's operations.
You've said on a number of occasions, quote, if opportunities in Pittsburgh are not for all, therefore none, end quote. So what specific steps will you take to address gender inequities as well as racial inequities?
So we have created a gender equity commission, probably the most talented commission board or authority that we have in the city, at least the resumes of the people that are serving on it. And their task is to look through the lens of what we've done with race. So we commissioned the City University of New York to work with us to measure racial inequity throughout the city of Pittsburgh, target the areas where the inequity is the greatest, provide us a priority list of what we need to address first, and then the other areas. And then we've worked with the Forbes Fund and Neighborhood Allies in order to measure what we're doing on an annual basis, benchmark it, and demand improvement. We need to do the same thing on gender inequity. And understanding gender equity goes far beyond the number of women that are in leadership roles. It goes far beyond pay equity. it is across the board on access to opportunity. And once we have a study that is complete and we're talking with local universities in order to be able to do that, once that is completed, then we have the opportunity to do the exact same thing that we do with race, which is measure it, put it up, put it out, let the public know, and then year by year, demand improvement.
Short-term goals for this Office of Equity?
To be able to utilize information and data over the course of the next year to be able to provide back to the public where inequity is the greatest with the power of our budget. To be able to say this is where low-income neighborhoods are being adversely affected, and then being able to work with neighborhood allies and other nonprofits to be able to put together the roadmap to address it.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Fatal opioid overdoses dropped by nearly half last year in Allegheny County. Meantime, arrests by state and federal law enforcement authorities of suspected dealers continue to rise. Scott Brady said attacking the opioid crisis has been his number one priority since becoming U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania 18 months ago. He told me he approaches it as a supply and demand challenge.
We attack the supply side in law enforcement. Our partners in the medical community and the treatment community attack the demand side, and they have to work together in concert. So what we saw was there were three main sources of supply that we had to disrupt. One was traditional drug trafficking, transnational groups that were bringing drugs and opioids primarily from Mexico. We saw the dark net, where opioids, heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil were being sold on the dark web. So we have put all of our cyber resources into attacking that with success. And then third was diversion, and diversion is a significant problem. Let me say 99% of the medical community is doing this the right way. What we are looking for is that 1% that is abusing their oath and running what are colloquially called pill mills, where it's really right. Just cash for pills without any concern of patient care or treatment, just to make money. And so we have targeted those and prosecuted more doctors who are illegally prescribing opioids than any U.S. Attorney's Office in the country.
Idea of approximately how many?
We have prosecuted 17 doctors and medical professionals since the middle of 2017.
Is that having a big impact, both in terms of removing those 17 as well as maybe a deterrence to others?
We believe it's having a significant effect. When there are doctors that are running pill mills, when they are just abusing people's addiction, exploiting people's addiction for financial gain, when you not only prosecute people publicly, you strip them of their medical license, and you put doctors in jail, the entire community sits up and takes notice. And we think it's having an incredible deterrent effect.
You mentioned, I guess, the traditional drug dealers, the doctors who are legally prescribing, and the dark net. Is that third the most difficult to crack down upon?
It is, but not impossible. And the challenge of the dark net is that you have marketplaces and sellers in an anonymized sub-ecosystem, as it were, who can go with what they believe impunity and anonymously sell everything that is illegal on the dark web. It's shocking when you go to these dark web marketplaces and you search carfentanil, fentanyl, child pornography, firearms. It's a supermarket. It's a Target or Walmart of illegal things. Where we come in is Pittsburgh has the premier cyber investigators in the FBI field office, cyber prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And so we have been successful in not only identifying and prosecuting individual sellers, we go after the largest sellers on these marketplaces, but also taking down marketplaces. And in our deep.web case that we announced 3 weeks ago, attacking the infrastructure that supports the entire dark web.
The overall number of opioid fatal overdoses has been on the decline. Is that strictly due to the greater availability of the sort of the anti-overdose medication naloxone, or is it a combined, is there a combined influence on that number, I should say?
An epidemic of this scope requires a broad response from all of the parties that are involved. So it involves an aggressive law enforcement response. It involves a sustained response by the treatment community and by first responders with naloxone, and then education of citizens, of children, of kids in schools. You can't pinpoint one particular thing that has been most effective. Obviously, the prevalence and distribution of naloxone has been absolutely critical to saving people's lives. However, we believe that our aggressive response from federal law enforcement has been instrumental in 42% decrease in overdose deaths in 2018. When you compare that to the other regions of the country that are most heavily affected, Southern District of Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, while they are seeing progress, they are not seeing the kind of progress that we've witnessed in the Western District.
How much of a partnership is that, federal, state, local?
It's a terrific partnership. Part of the response requires an all-hands-on-deck response. What we bring to the fight is our resources that the state and our local DAs don't have. So we can go after people if they're in Mexico. We can go after manufacturers of fentanyl analogs. If they're in China, we can serve subpoenas all over the world, or all over the country. Sometimes the state and local law enforcement is limited by the borders. We don't have that.
Are you fighting a losing battle, a winning battle? Are you at a sort of a stalemate, just trying to hold ground? What?
I would say that as long as people in Western Pennsylvania are addicted to opioids and are dying from them, then our mission is ongoing. I think one thing that we are seeing is that we can be successful, and that encourages me and it makes me want to double our efforts and double down and work even harder, because we know that the harder we work and the more drug trafficking organizations we prosecute, the more dark net marketplaces we take down, the safer the people in Western Pennsylvania are.
Scott Brady is the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania. Thanks so much, sir.
Thank you, Kevin.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Percy Sledge's song "When a Man Loves a Woman" made music history on this day in 1966 when it became the first song recorded at Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama to hit number one. Over the following decades, the studio run by Rick Hall would see hits from Aretha Franklin, Paul Simon, and the Rolling Stones, among others. This recording is also famous for being one of two number one hits featuring vocal work from Donna Jean Godshaw of the Grateful Dead. "When a Man Loves a Woman" became a number one hit for the second time in 1991 when it was covered by Michael Bolton. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 2017 was the first time in nearly two decades that incidents of harassment toward LGBT students did not decrease. That's according to the educational organization GLSEN, which conducts a national school survey on the treatment of LGBTQ youth. One indicator of a safe school is the existence of a strong GSA, or Gender Sexuality Alliance. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley visited area GSAs to see how the group's roles have evolved.
Lucas Pater is eyeing a table filled with sweets while his mom Dina looks on.
Great, there's chocolate.
12-year-old Lucas and his mom are at a potluck held monthly by the Washington County GSA. The room is packed with people who identify across the LGBTQ spectrum. This diverse display of gender expression is exactly what appealed to the Paters about this group.
It's nice to have a place where I can be myself, because I just came out of school, and so not everyone is caught on. And it's nice to be at a place where they've only known you as who you really are, and there's no mess-ups.
By mess-ups, Lucas means being misgendered or having someone use his old name. Lucas is transgender, and negative interactions like that can cause significant harm. His middle school doesn't have a GSA, so his mother brought him here to meet people who have had similar experiences.
I know everybody here is going to be accepting and loving and just accept him for who he is, and there's not going to be any kind of social awkwardness for him.
According to research by the advocacy group GLSEN, because Lucas is involved with the GSA, he's more likely to have a sense of belonging in his community, perform well in school, and have higher self-esteem. But Lucas is growing up in a notable time, according to GLSEN Senior Research Associate Nian Truong.
Unfortunately, in the 2017 National School Climate Survey report, we found an increase in negative transgender remarks, as well as increase in verbal harassment regarding gender expression.
These incidents had been declining since GLSEN started surveying students 20 years ago. Truong says the new findings might be due to an increase in public discourse about trans and gender nonconforming students. Brashear High School senior Avery Steck says in her case, more discussion led to positive changes. Steck is also transgender and says during her time at Brashear, she's become the GSA mom, who younger students turn to for advice and support. Plus, when she was a freshman, she advocated for Pittsburgh Public Schools' transgender student policy. Previously, the district had no guidelines for students who asked to use the restrooms that aligned with their gender identity instead of their sex assigned at birth.
Use the proper restroom, use our name and pronouns, have it changed in the system, addressing confidentiality and who can and can't discuss our trans status.
More school districts throughout western Pennsylvania are beginning to adopt policies like this. Brashear GSA advisor Devin Brown says this is a good step, but it's only effective if the school's culture supports it. Brown says since his school's group began, it's become more visible.
It went from like 9 years ago, kids trying to quietly join the GSA, to now like a kid will holler in the cafeteria to me like, yo, Mr. Brown, how do I join the GSA?
The conversations students have during GSA events and meetings have also changed since such organizations first formed in the late 1980s. Members have always fought against homophobia and transphobia, but they've also focused on policy issues like the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the legalization of same-sex marriage. Brown says now, students talk about the treatment of transgender members of the military and non-discrimination policies.
What's happening in our society is really reflects the kind of issues that our students are talking about in schools.
After all, these students are thinking about their futures. The majority of Western Pennsylvania counties don't protect LGBTQ people against discrimination. So if these young people enter the workforce openly gay, they could be fired. For now, GSAs are still a safe place for them to practice advocacy, navigate their sexuality, and, of course, make friends. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A growing network of survivors of abuse among the conservative Amish and Mennonite communities is trying to reform a culture that they say puts young people at risk and often doesn't turn to authorities, even when sexual assault is widely known. Church leaders say they have improved practices and now cooperate with law enforcement. But is that enough? And what is the faith community doing to prevent future harm? The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is tackling these questions and more in a six-part series that debuted last week. The Confluence's Megan Harris recently talked to the journalists behind the stories, reporters Peter Smith and Shelley Bradbury, with photojournalist Stephanie Strasberg.
When did the issue of sex abuse in Amish and Mennonite communities come to your attention? Peter, let's start with you.
Came to our attention about a year ago, actually, as we were beginning to really cover the run-up to the release of the grand jury report into sexual abuse in the Roman Catholic Church. And one day I received a phone tip from someone who had seen one of our articles and said, you know, this is happening in our communities too. And if you really want to know more, here's who you need to talk to. And that person linked us to other people, and it went on from there.
Remind us, where are the Plain communities around our region? How many people does that include?
They are in numerous settlements throughout this region, most famously in Lancaster County. That's the largest. Also, Holmes County in northeastern Ohio is probably the second largest. But in numerous other places throughout, up in Mifflinburg and Huntington County area, Lawrence County, Indiana County, numerous places in Ohio, and then going beyond into Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, The Amish alone are in at least 30 states and provinces, 330,000 or so nationwide. Now, the Mennonites are a much more diverse group, as you may know. What we are focusing on are what are known as the Plain people that live a much more separatist life. Women wear head coverings and very distinctive dress, maybe 80, 90,000, maybe more. There's no one database that can answer that easily.
So as you're reporting the story, what do you think it means within the community to be plain?
It means to not be caught up with what the world says is valuable, what the world says is beautiful, to realize, and this is speaking from their perspective, that beauty is spiritual, it comes from within, and that outside adornments, whether it's colorful clothing, colorful trinkets, jewelry, makeup, any of that, is worldly and does not endure and distracts from the kingdom of God. As it applies especially to women who are told to keep covered, wear some sort of head covering, whether full or symbolic, wear very long and very loose dresses. There is a very strong culture of purity, which what the survivors have told us over and over again is whatever else you can say about it, they were promised that if you keep pure, you will be protected, and they were not. As one survivor said, if the clothing kept us protected, there would be no rape among us, and yet there is.
The other part of that, too, is that the women and girls who survive abuse are often shamed for their abuse, for failing to maintain their purity. And, you know, maybe if a girl was abused, somebody might say, well, why was she running outside barefoot? You know, why didn't she keep her dress down? Why were her elbows showing? So there's this double trauma for the victims because they go through the abuse itself, and then the community often rejects them afterwards by saying, well, this is your fault. You didn't maintain the purity that we demand from women. There's often very little shaming of the perpetrator.
That sounds like it echoes a little bit of what we would consider secular culture.
Yeah, those themes definitely go throughout many different cultures and across many different, especially religious settings, I would say.
Yeah. So, Shelley, you tend to cover criminal justice. How do you begin to tackle this story? As you write in your pieces, court cases like this aren't exactly categorized by religious affiliation.
Yeah, that was one of the major struggles, was trying to get some sort of sense of the scope of the problem. This was one of those stories where, like, everybody we talked to knew somebody else who had a similar story, and it just kept growing from there. So we pretty easily and pretty quickly had, like, a network of people who wanted to talk about it and who had experienced it, but we didn't necessarily have, like, court records to go with all their cases and those kinds of things that you need to put something in print. So we took a variety of approaches to try to nail down exactly how many cases there were in the state. And we eventually found something like 25 confirmed, definitely plain cases where abusers had been charged and in most cases convicted. A few of those are still going through the court system. So once we had like that network of people who wanted to talk about it, then we had to go back through the court system and try to actually nail down what we could say definitively.
What aspects would you say of plain community tradition can make it hard for survivors to get justice around sex assault cases?
A number of things. For one, it's a very separatist community, and this goes right back to their beginnings, right at the start of the Protestant Reformation. They were on the most radical edge of it. They said, we don't want to just go from a Catholic state church to a Protestant state church. We are separating from society. And it's not that they didn't believe that they should obey the laws of the earthly kingdom, but they had a two-kingdom theology that really put the focus on living for the heavenly kingdom. So you combine that with a crime that even in general society is taken a long time for people to really be recognized as a crime and as something to be reported. So there was a real reluctance, even among those who might have wanted to go to the civil authorities and report it. But then also they have a very strict church disciplinary culture, so that these would be considered offenses that needed to be addressed in some form within the church by the church elders, and then stay there, you know, especially if the perpetrator repented. So they would say, okay, he's repented. We forgive him. We will not speak of this any further.
So historically, there wasn't as much of a precedent for reporting outside the Plain community?
Virtually zero. Now, it's not that they wouldn't recognize the role of the law in prosecuting crimes in general, but in this particular case, the idea that there was some sort of obligation to report, whether morally or legally, is a very, very new realization.
Shelley, you mentioned that network. You guys spent so much time immersed in these communities, talking to people. Stephanie, you especially, I'm curious your observations as you were hearing these stories and becoming, at least in a small way, a part of their lives.
It was really, as a photographer, this story was extremely difficult because not only were there ethical issues, there were legal issues, and there were cultural issues that we had to be mindful of. So each story kind of has its own approach visually. And for me, it was really interesting to figure out how to bring almost like a side story to the stories that Shelley and Peter were writing about. So spending so much time with certain families and certain people was really illuminating because little things come out as you go along that you wouldn't even know to ask about if you weren't a part of the community. So when we were talking to a family called the Burkholders, Jim and Diane Burkholder, who just had this really incredible story. They met when they were teenagers, and they both admit that their relationship started with rape. And Diane ended up getting pregnant out of wedlock, while Jim was allowed to become a member of the church. Since she was pregnant and not married, she was not allowed to become a member of the church. And their story kind of grew and evolved from there, and they ended up having 11 children before Diane finally kind of had this moment of realization about what was going on in her relationship. And they have since left the community and changed the dynamics of their relationship, which they both admit was very sexually abusive. And it was fascinating to me to learn that one of the reasons that sex is seen as connected with love there is because in the Old Order Mennonite community that they were coming from, you don't express any affirmations of love or encouragement to your children because it's seen as giving them pride. And so there was a moment where Diane's friend asked her, "Do you ever tell your children that you love them?" And she lied and said yes, and she assumed that she told them that she loved them through giving them food and giving them clothes and things like that, giving them shelter. But she realized that because she had been so emotionally spent from having all of these children and from living this life where she was expected to please her husband at, you know, the drop of a dime while she's nursing one baby and pregnant with another, that she had emotionally neglected her children. And so there was a moment where she realized, I need to tell my children that I love them. And there's all of these little things that, you know, going into this project, I just really would not have even known to begin to ask. And it's been really incredible to learn more about what that is.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, joined in studio by Post-Gazette journalists Shelley Bradbury, Peter Smith, and Stephanie Strasberg. Their six-part series on sex assault in Plain communities debuted last week. Stick with us on 90.5 WESA. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, joined in studio still by Shelley Bradbury and Peter Smith, as well as Stephanie Strasberg, three journalists from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, whose new six-part series on sex assault in the Plain communities debuted last week. Shelley, I'm curious, as you were beginning to tackle this story and look at all of these court cases, how did you pick which ones you wanted to talk about, and how did you approach the people that were involved in them? It's such an intimate story and one that I'm sure they're still grappling with in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, that was a very interesting challenge as we reported this. I think we ended up basing most of our stories around people who wanted their stories to be told, like they came to us versus us coming to them. We also focused on some of the cases that are ongoing. One thing I wanted to touch on was the total reliance of the community members on their churches. That was something that we found as being a major issue as to why abuse was not being reported outside the church. because if you think about it, the churches control basically every aspect of their members' lives. So your kids go to a church-run school. The church often controls or has a big part of your livelihood. Many of your customers in your business might be church members. Sometimes the church is part of your insurance. You have like a collective that you buy into, mm-hmm. and your entire community socially is church members. So breaking away from that and doing something that the church doesn't sanction is extremely hard to do.
Who would you say is reporting the abuse? Is it only members who've left the community, or do others still within its confines feel like it's safe to do so?
Both and. Most of the people that we had access to were those who have left their communities. They were the most forthcoming about it, but we have learned of cases that were reported from within the communities.
How are authorities reacting then when they get reports of abuse?
You know, these are often investigated in rural counties where they take place, and it's like they come to a realization one county at a time that, hey, this is a thing, this is something that we need to investigate.
Shelley.
One thing that's been really interesting is that we've heard from law enforcement throughout this project is that if you confront a plain person about their sin, they will often confess it to law enforcement without much prodding. So many of the cases that are being prosecuted now, there's actually been a confession by the perpetrator to what they did, which is like a big part of the
faith. Their religious faith.
Yeah, is like confessing and receiving forgiveness. And for some of the people that we've looked at, they really had a sense that, you know, this is fine. This is dealt with. Like I, for example, Martha's father, who was featured in our first story, he, you know, said, you know, yeah, I did this. I confessed it to the church years ago. I was forgiven and we've all moved on and this is a closed matter. So there's really a sense among the perpetrators that like this has been dealt with and it shouldn't go any further outside of the church.
But not the survivors, I imagine.
Not the survivors, yeah. Martha was actually, the abuse was reported to her pastor close to when it happened. And the pastor sat them both down and you know, said, Martha, you need to forgive your father for what he's done to you. And at the end of that conversation, she was told to hug him. And, you know, she refused. This man had abused her sexually. And the pastor just, when he was talking to law enforcement, he was like, yeah, that was really puzzling. She seemed really angry. And you know, I thought something was wrong, but I wasn't sure what. So there's this sense, and forgiveness is super important among the plain people. So much so, like, in 2006, a gunman went into an Amish schoolhouse.
West Nickel Mines.
Yes, in Lancaster County. He shot 10 girls, 5 died. And, like, later that night, the Amish elders in that community went to the man's family and said, you know, we forgive this man for what he's done. We forgive you. We don't hold any ill will against you. And that was, like, super lauded. Everybody got was, you know, like, this is amazing what they're doing. And it was amazing. But it also, what we found is that there's kind of a dark side to that forgiveness as well, where if you don't forgive as a victim, you're ostracized for not forgiving. So if
is that the most common response, excommunication or expectation that you forgive or else?
Yes, definitely. We actually spoke with one woman who her husband abused their children. He confessed it to the church and the church told him to confess it to the congregation. And he did that. And then he was supposed to be forgiven. And when his wife refused to forgive him and refused to take him back into her life, then she was actually excommunicated from the church rather than he. So there's definitely this sense of once a sin has been confessed and forgiven, we need to move on and not just like move on we're moving past this, but we're remembering that it happened kind of a way, but in a this never happened, we're going to act as though this never happened. You're back to your full status.
So historically, maybe not the best response, particularly immediately after a crime is committed. Are they changing? Is the community evolving in how they deal with these crimes?
There is certainly a greater awareness. There have been, you know, even within the communities, they have attempted to do more education about it. They've begun to form committees, one that got started in Lancaster and it's being duplicated elsewhere, that are set up to be liaisons between law enforcement, child protective services, and the communities. committee men that we spoke with were very adamant that when there is abuse to be reported, they report it. It will take some time for the community of survivors and that are outside these communities to fully trust that process. I think they may need to do more to earn that trust, but that is beginning.
Peter, as you mentioned before, your primary reporting beat with the Post-Gazette is religion. How would you say that this compares maybe to what we're seeing play out in the Catholic Church or even Baptist or other Protestant faiths or the Me Too movement for that matter?
Most of what we have heard about in Catholic and other Protestant faiths has to do with what you might call professional misconduct. These are the professional clergy that are committing these crimes. And the question is usually is anyone holding them to account or not? Particularly with the Catholic case, this has been going on 40 years now. There's a lot more that's out in the public with the plain communities. Cases have come out here and there, but in terms of any comprehensive understanding of it, we're way, way at the beginning of that. And also, because they don't have professionalized clergy, it's really a different dynamic. This is usually cases of abuse within the family or within communities, and then it comes to the church's attention, and then how do they handle it?
The plain communities are very fragmented. So each church has its own traditions and regulations and procedures. So it's really difficult to make sweeping generalizations about the whole plain community, because every sect, every little community has its own set of guidelines. The community is super connected in how word travels. It's sort of like that everybody knows when one person knows kind of a community.
So are plain community members then concerned about the issue of sexual assault in their day-to-day lives? And are there activists or others working within or from outside the community to maybe make a difference, to make a change? Steph?
There's really a groundswell of activism coming out right about now within the Plain community. One of the things that really helped educate us was this podcast called the Plain People's Podcast. There's a man named Mark Masoner and Jasper Hoffman. They're both former conservative Mennonites who have left the community and have their own stories and histories of abuse within the community. And they are basically producing a podcast that allows people to come and share their experience within the community. And a lot of times those end up being stories of abuse. They are also connected with another activist that we have spoken to a lot for this project named Trudy Metzger, who lives in Ontario, Canada, also a former Mennonite. She has basically been organizing people through social media, through her workshops that she goes around and gives, through her own book and things like that. There's another woman named Joanna Yoder, who I was able to go on a road trip with through Kentucky and Tennessee as she visited her places where she was abused and where she went to report her case to law enforcement. As she went down to Tennessee, she was basically informing the police department down there, the sheriff's department, about what was going on. And they had really very little idea that this was going on in their Plain communities. They had always seen the Plain communities as these pillars of law-abiding citizens. She went to the Capitol there and talked with lawmakers about a bill that's coming up that would extend the statute of limitations there. So all of these people are starting to come together and connect their stories and realize that they're not alone and that this is something that's going on not just with them but across the communities. And people are starting to feel emboldened to come out and share their stories and move forward and demand greater accountability and also demand that clergy take mandated reporting classes and things like that. So there's a couple different angles that people are hitting it with. There's the activists are looking for the spiritual transformation, the accountability from the church, and an extension of statute of limitations from the government.
Stephanie Strasberg is a photojournalist at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette with reporters Shelley Bradbury and Peter Smith. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us on The Confluence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was The Confluence's Megan Harris. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, kids exposed to coke oven emissions have higher rates of cancer. How long does it take for emissions to have an impact? And why are children particularly at risk? plus the final installment of our series, Still Working. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich and Julia Maruka. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.